is the news.
Headlines. Iran's leader says the enemy is propagating lies to sway ill-informed individuals and trigger riots, but Iranians will thwart all those schemes. Russia slams as provocative Poland's refusal to allow Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to attend an upcoming meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And FIFA President Gianni Infantino blasts what he calls the hypocrisy of Western critics of Qatar's human rights record on the eve of the world's biggest soccer tournament. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution leader says the U.S., backed by Europe, is at the forefront of hegemonic power's campaign against the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah said that Khamenei made the remarks in an address to a group of people from Iran's central province of Isfahan. He said all U.S. presidents, be it Democrat or Republican, have been leading the fight against the Islamic Republic since the early days of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Khamenei said all U.S. presidents sought help from whoever at their disposal, including the Israeli regime and some regional countries, to stand against the Islamic Republic. The leader said the enemy is utilizing a whole range of resources, including satellite networks and cyberspace, to dash the Iranians' hope. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that anti-Iran media are spreading lies on a massive scale. They're trying to give the impression that large numbers of people are opposed to the Islamic establishment in order to impress ignorant individuals. However, the leader noted that the people's mass presence on stage to safeguard the Islamic Revolution amounts to a slap in the face of the ill-wishers. People in the Iranian city of Mashhad have held a funeral procession for three Basij volunteer force members who were stabbed to death by rioters earlier this week. Mourners called on authorities to bring the murderers to justice. Other regions in Iran have also been targeted by rioters or terrorists in recent days. They include the central province of Isfahan, where several security forces were killed. On Wednesday, at least seven people were killed after terrorists opened fire on people and security forces at a crowded market in Izeh in Khuzestan province. Among the dead were a woman and a child. University professor Mohammad Mirandi says foreign governments have used their agents inside of Iran to ruthlessly murder innocent people, but have put the blame on the Iranian government.
Over the last two, 3 days, we've seen an upsurge in the number of police officers and Basij members massacred by these thugs in Isfahan, in Mashhad, in Bukhan, and of course in Izeh. Now, what is unique about Izeh is that now these thugs that have murdered these innocent people and injured police officers, they are alongside the Persian media based in London and Western countries trying to blame the government for these murders. And it's clear who benefits from these acts. It's obvious which countries benefit from the death of innocent people in Iran. So we have to make, I think the government has to start changing its policy. And those governments that are behind this, those Western governments and those regional governments that are behind this, have to pay a heavy price. This is the continuation of these policies where the police are left vulnerable, the Basij are left vulnerable, is unacceptable. Western countries, their agents will kill ordinary people and then blame the police.
Iran says it's going to take reciprocal action against the Western-sponsored IAEA resolution, which it calls unconstructive. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says the West has abused the UN agency's status for political purposes. He argues the resolution is part of the U.S. policy of maximum pressure on Iran. The top diplomat criticized the U.S. behavior toward Iran as highly hypocritical. resolution calls on Tehran to fully cooperate with the IAEA's probe into what it claims to be uranium traces at three undeclared sites in Iran. Tehran says the IAEA probe is based on fabricated information given to the agency by the Israeli regime. Russia slams as provocative and unprecedented Poland's decision to bar Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov from attending regional security talks. The Russian Foreign Ministry says Warsaw's decision undermines the basis for establishing security cooperation, adding that the organization has become a platform for anti-Russia moves. The ministry also said that Warsaw has discredited itself, causing irreparable damage to the credibility of the organization. On Friday, Poland announced that it would not allow the Russian delegation to attend the Organization for Security and Cooperation meeting next month. The Polish government said that Sergei Lavrov is on the list of sanctioned individuals over the war in Ukraine and therefore should not be allowed to attend the meeting. The Russian delegation will be led by Russia's permanent representative to the OSCE, Alexander Lukashevich, instead. FIFA President Gianni Infantino has slammed European countries, calling out the hypocrisy of those who criticize the World Cup host Qatar over moral issues.
I think for what we Europeans have been doing in the last 3,000 years around the world, we should be apologizing for the next 3,000 years before starting to give moral lessons to people. This moral lesson giving, one-sided, it's just hypocrisy. I don't want to give you any lessons of life. I'm just realizing that what is going on here is profoundly, profoundly unjust.
Infantino, who will stand unopposed for re-election as FIFA president next March, argued that while Europe does not allow any of the migrants to work legally inside the EU borders, Qatar offers them real opportunities. Qatar hired 30,000 laborers from some Asian countries to build stadiums, as well as some other infrastructure. 6,500 of those migrants working on the projects have been reported dead by the respective embassies. That has drawn heavy criticism from human rights groups. The UK government has unveiled an emergency budget. It includes tens of billions of dollars in spending cuts and tax increases as the government seeks to restore its economic credibility and patch up the nation's battered finances. Syed Puruza has more from London.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new Chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled.
Yeah, yeah.
Savings depleted.
Yeah.
Hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries. This was a crisis made in Downing Street, and it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. Whereas with when they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra cost to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
Israel has performed yet another missile attack against targets on Syrian soil, despite repeated calls by Damascus to stop such violations by Syrian sovereignty. We've discussed the matter with our guests in our news review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Israel has conducted fresh missile attacks on Syria, killing four soldiers and wounding another. The attacks hit several locations in central and coastal areas of Syria. They were carried out from the direction of the Mediterranean coastal city of Bani Aws in northwestern Syria. Material damage were also caused. The Tel Aviv regime has time and again conducted air attacks on Syrian soil, despite repeated calls by Damascus to stop them. Syria says the attacks are a violation of its sovereignty. It has frequently called on the UN to force the regime to stop the strikes. To discuss that further, we're joined by Barry Grossman, political analyst, joining us live from Bali, Indonesia, and also Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, is joining us live from Manchester. Let's begin with Mr. Grossman. Why, in your opinion, does Israel have impunity, not only as an occupying power over the Golan Heights, but also in the use of military force against Syria?
Well, it's been quite obvious for a very long time that the Atlantic world agenda for the region, and in particular for Palestine, is one and the same as the occupation's agenda for Palestine. And insofar as they work together, both their security apparatus, their intelligence apparatus, and to some extent their political apparatus, of course they run political interference for each other. It's almost political suicide in most Atlantic world countries to say anything critical of the occupation regime in Tel Aviv. And of course, we've seen that over and over again, with the regime actually reaching out and interfering in the domestic political affairs of other nations. The example that comes to mind, of course, is the United Kingdom, where no matter how senior political leaders are, their careers are ended the moment the regime starts spending resources and organizing to denounce those individuals as being anti-Semites, entirely on the basis of their criticism of matters which are connected with Zionism and war crimes and other abuses, rather than anything to do with being Jewish. So it takes a very strong-willed person committed to positions of principle to even dare to voice criticism in the world of politics today. And I think those people are sadly missing. They've learned the hard way, those people who remain in politics, that if there's one subject that's completely out of bounds, it's criticism of the occupation regime and what it does throughout the region and indeed the wider world. And one obvious example is this ongoing bombing by the regime in Syria, which is quite blatantly contrary to international law. They rarely acknowledge it. When they do, they put forward excuses which make no sense and are premised on their claim that their occupation of the Golan Heights is somehow legitimate, when the position in international law is quite the opposite.
So, Mr. Ford, in your opinion, Israel, we see it is firing missiles into Syria, which is a sovereign country. It is using Lebanon's airspace, another sovereign country, to do so. And the UN Security Council is ignoring calls by Syria to react to this type of aggression in a tangible manner. How is this possible?
It's very difficult for Syria to react militarily, because the Israelis cleverly often hide behind civilian aircraft when they're conducting these attacks. And the Israelis would be more than happy if an accident were to occur, and then Syria would be very heavily blamed by the world. But diplomatically, Syria can react by taking its case to the United Nations, and it does this repeatedly, but obviously to no effect because of the way the United Nations are controlled by the US and its NATO allies in terms of any forceful response to Israel's continual breaking of international law. The most that Syria can do is to try to improve its air defenses, and even that is very difficult at the moment with Russia, which has helped in this respect, apparently being obliged to move some of its air defense systems to the Ukraine area. And therefore, we have seen this year alone at least 30 Israeli attacks on Syria, and very little, I'm afraid, that Syria can do about it.
Thank you very much. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria from Manchester, and Barry Grossman, political analyst from Bali, Indonesia. Thank you very much, both of you gentlemen, for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review.
And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
Given the lower cost and shorter time of trade via this route, Iran can become the main trade link between Asia and Europe and effectively neutralize the U.S. measures aimed to isolate the Islamic Republic from the global economy. Also, Iran and Venezuela have inked a series of major accords that will definitely make Caracas, its economy, and the welfare of its people immune to any more sabotage by Washington. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Please stay tuned for the first part. Kayhan, international staff writer, wrote, "It is highly said, but for the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran would have continued to be a U.S. client state, and in view of its vast and varied resources, including oil and natural gas, as well as its strategic geopolitical status, a dairy cow to perpetually nourish the Americans." Well, if and but are nothing more than mere wishes stuck in the peanut-sized brains of the ignorantly arrogant Yankees who hate the Islamic Republic and are totally blind to ground realities in Iran and the resolve of its awakened Muslim people. As a result, they continue to imagine that they can still bring back Iran into the American orbit through a bunch of thugs, terrorists, and traitors indulging in the most abominable acts, even if these outcasts of the society are detested by the overwhelming majority of the staunchly Muslim and strongly nationalist Iranian people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is thus the prime example of the repeated failures of Washington's unwise policies, which have failed almost all over the world, as is evident by the inability of the U.S. regime, despite their intensive subversive acts and spending of billions of dollars to try to dupe and buy people, whether in Asia, Africa, or Latin America. The last-named continent, which the U.S. used to consider its backyard and spurred no hegemonic plot to plunder its rich resources in order to deprive its people of their heritage, including the right to democracy and independence, has now emerged as a bastion against Anglo-Saxon imperialism. This has angered Uncle Sam, and after decades of sanctions against Cuba that miserably failed, it singled out oil-rich Venezuela. But here also, it has failed to overthrow its fiercely independent government in spite of resorting to every dirty trick, such as economic terrorism and coups that collapsed. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as part of its principal policy of helping nations in distress, has built solid bridges with Venezuela and several other Latino states. This policy is reaping rich harvests for Iran, while enabling the victims of U.S. oppression to firmly stand on their feet to fend off Yankee bullying. The other day, Iran and Venezuela inked a series of major accords that will definitely make Caracas, its economy, and the welfare of its people immune to any more sabotage by Washington. Early this year in June, the two countries had signed a 20-year cooperation plan, which involves Iranian assistance in repair and maintenance of Venezuelan refineries, as well as other technical and engineering expertise. The two nations also signed a deal whereby Iran will deliver 4 oil tankers to Venezuela, while weekly flights between Caracas and Tehran commenced in July. Iran, which sends fleets of fuel-laden tanker ships to alleviate Venezuela's crisis and also help export Venezuela's crude oil to defeat U.S. sanctions, had in 2020 launched in Caracas the giant supermarket Megasis, spread some 200,000 square feet and supplying to eager customers over 2,500 different Iranian products. In view of these developments, the recent announcement in Tehran by Venezuelan Minister of Transport Romanov purchase of 1,000 cars built in Iran as part of a major deal for importing the first batch of 80,000 cars from various Iranian car manufacturers came as no surprise. Velazquez, who participated in seven joint committees of the two countries involving the Venezuelan public sector and the private sector of Iran, concluded agreements in such varied fields as agriculture, industry, science and technology, as well as in health and education. He said, "With Iran, we have built real ties of brotherhood, cooperation and mutual assistance to strengthen bilateral relations in order to realize our dreams of living freely." The U.S. regime is red with rage at Iran's staking out a niche in South America's automotive marketplace, which has a lot of space for growth and expansion, but it cannot do anything except propagandizing false narratives of turmoil in Iran, which the free world doesn't believe.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. The past few nights, we have been looking at some of those barriers, those mawani', those impeding forces that sometimes block us from achieving this desired identity. A lot of times, you know, we have to be a little bit careful of how we take the words of individuals. How we assume that this person will reject this new identity of mine. And the question that I have, and it's very difficult to turn inwards, is the reason why we put so much weight on that rejection because I've already rejected that identity? And now I just need one more person to rubber stamp it. Even though the reality is that I've seen individuals, I've seen people, that they find God. I've seen youth in this very city, east and west now, go through this journey, trying to figure things out, up and down, up and down. And they end up in a beautiful, pious place, God-fearing, God-conscious kid. Amazing. I couldn't believe it. Sometimes I don't see youth in the city for years. And after a while, when I see them, mashallah, amazing, involved in a community, right? He looks the part, for example. Beautiful questions. You can tell he's well-read in Islam. And my heart tells me that a lot of people must be very proud of him. So it's not even like the rejection is going to be loud. Sometimes it's a low whisper. Sometimes it's one person that will come to that kid and say, "Why are you going to Qum, to Najaf? You're in your 20s. This is the time for you to live your life and make your millions. You know, go there and sit in a cave on top of a mountain. You have it easy here. That's a desert there." One person, but 15 others, shabash, mashallah, right? All sorts of stuff. We're so proud of you. But all those are drowned out. The one whispering guy in the corner for some reason has my ear. That is a reflection of the fact that I myself am not sold on the path that I'm on. That's it. So a fear of rejection is actually an alarming bell. That's why some emotions that we have, while the West and other sciences might tell you that these are destructive emotions and they're heavy emotions, and you are now to relieve yourself of that weight, Islam says, wait a second now. What might seem like a difficult emotion on paper is actually a very good emotion for you. Guilt is one, and rejection is one. The fear of rejection is also one. That fear is very important. Guilt is, I tell you, sometimes when we commit a sin when nobody sees us. We're behind closed doors, nobody is there, it's me, myself, and me, and I commit a sin. And right after I commit a sin, I have this huge weight of guilt on me. The guilt would make sense if I committed the sin in front of everybody. If my kids saw me, if my wife saw me, if all of you saw me, oh my God, that guilt I have would kill me. But no one saw me. I'm behind closed doors, there's no cameras here, nothing's going, my phone was off, everything was... The fact that you still feel guilt when you're alone, you should tell you that your heart of your heart still, what? Recognizes another force inside that room. And that guilt is telling you that you're never alone. He's always Hadir and Nadir. He's always there. Imam Sajjad, alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala. Half of Tawbah, he says, is regret and remorse. Is this guilt that we feel. If you commit a sin, he says, and you don't feel remorse or guilt afterwards, be very, very scared. Either you've downplayed the sin, or you just kind of, made it a minor sin. And as Imam Ali says, a minor sin in your eyes is a major sin in his eyes. Now you might go to some other psychologist, will say, you know what? You don't need to feel guilty. You can remove that. Yes, no doubt. When we hold on to things, harbor things, I'm not saying all of guilt, but sometimes guilt now, we feel right away, is a sort of a sign that there's still a conscious inside of you. It's not all bad emotion. A fear of rejection is good. If you're worried, for example, if I'm worried that, okay, how will people view my lecture tonight? It forces me and it sets off alarm bells inside of me. That okay, if you're afraid about that, go back and review your notes. Make sure everything is solid. Everything is logical, it makes sense, it flows, all that. So it forces me to really perfect my craft, perfect my intention, perfect my delivery. If I didn't have the fear of rejection, you know what comes about? Ghurur, the ego. They won't reject me. Everything I deliver is bomb. It's beautiful. Top notch. When the fear of rejection is removed, you become somebody who ends up doing a little bit of, they say, khud parasti, worshipping yourself. So a fear of rejection can be very positive. Absolutely. But it does require us to remove the element from the outside and begin to look inwards. Have I already preemptively rejected this path? And just waiting for one person to tell me, not a good idea. I knew it, not a good idea. Because if we hold on to that for too long, the fear, it becomes something that might even cripple us. I'll give you a very simple example. I want you to imagine that you are holding a very light bottle of water. That wasn't planned, it just happened to be there. Light bottle of water. Okay? I hold it right now, it's okay, it's light. I'm a big boy, I can handle it. Not a big deal. If I hold it like this for about 5 minutes, I'm good. 10 minutes, I'm good. An hour, like this. 2 hours, 3 hours, 18 hours. Has the volume changed in this bottle? No. Has the weight changed? No. It's still 500 milliliters. But for some reason, it's the heaviest bottle I've ever carried in my life. Now my arm is shaking. Now I have to, I have to put it down. Now this thing becomes unbearably heavy. Nothing has changed. But I held on to it for too long. When you hold on to things for too long and you don't address them properly, they become too heavy to bear. And everything. I mean, stress, you know, anxiety, depression, these things have to, these things require an outlet. And everybody has their own individual outlet, inshallah, whatever that is. Prayer, journaling, a spouse, a coffee run, whatever it is. This fear of rejection has to be tackled, but internally. And that's the difficult part. We're okay when it comes to others. We have other people figured out. We really do. If you can work on this, brother, you'd be perfect. You need to work on this. Oh, all sorts of, you know, I can tell you exactly what you need to do. But when you look in the mirror, like right now, this glass is in front of me, I can see myself in the glass. It's quite strange. That's why I know my hair, my hat is way off. I can to see myself. That is scary. The person in the mirror is telling you, okay, what do you need to work on? And I, at that moment, I have nothing. You ask me about my wife and my kids and my parents and my brothers and my cousins. Oh, I have a long list. When it comes to me, I don't have anything. And the reality is that if I am that journey towards Allah, I have to know me. Another simple example, I'm sorry. You decide to drive to Vancouver. Long drive. Right? Cross country. Drive through Manitoba, you know, get through the beautiful area of Banff, for example, and then get into BC. The first thing you'll do is you'll figure out what is my vehicle. Okay? And you want to make sure that you know the vehicle inside and out. Full tank of gas, oil, check the brakes, check the tires, all that. You know how fast the car can go. You know how long the car can drive. You know, for example, I can't go past 120 on the highway. You know after about 8-9 hours, got to pull over, grab a hotel, start again in the morning. You know that because you know the vehicle. Because if, God forbid, between here and Vancouver, your car breaks down, you won't get to your destination. The vehicle, the wasila, is very, very important. And you must know the ins and outs. Don't push the accelerator too much. Don't do this. Don't rev this. Don't do that. Okay, no problem. Don't overheat it. Turn the AC low. You know everything about that vehicle. Because that vehicle will get you to your destination. The I that I talked about 4 or 5 nights ago is the vehicle from me to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل
عليه. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime has killed 9 Palestinians so far in November. This is while, in most cases, the Palestinians did not pose any danger to the Zionist regime troops. Palestinians have said they will resist until the liberation of Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The first week of November saw 9 Palestinians killed by the Zionist regime occupation forces. This has been the deadliest year in the West Bank on a monthly average since the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs began systematically tracking fatalities in 2005. Last month, for instance, the Zionist regime military killed on average 1 Palestinian every day. As Palestinians in the West Bank continue their resistance against the Israeli regime's occupation, this average shows no sign of letting up. On November 14th, the Israeli regime army killed a 15-year-old Palestinian girl in the town of Beitunia near Ramallah. She was identified as Fulah al-Maslameh from a town in the southern West Bank. The Zionist regime army said a vehicle approached them during a military incursion into Beituna and refused to stop when ordered. They opened fire on the vehicle, killing al-Maslumah. On November 9th, a 29-year-old man was shot and killed by Zionist regime forces in Jenin. The Palestinian Health Ministry confirmed his identity as Rafat Ali Abdullah Ayesh. He was from the village of Sanur near Jenin. Initially, the Zionist regime troops detained Ayesh and then turned him over to the Red Crescent, which transferred him to hospital in critical condition where he was declared dead. Red Crescent Ambulance Service head Mahmoud Saadi told the Palestinian news agency Wafa. Israeli regime occupation forces also killed a child overnight on November 9th during an incursion into the city of Nablus. The Israeli regime army was escorting a group of right-wing Israeli lawmakers attending an event at Joseph Tomb, an archaeological site located in the city, which is considered sacred by Muslims, Christians, and Jews. The settler visit went ahead even though senior Israeli regime army officials had reportedly objected. A division commander approved it in the end. Youths including Muhammad Hamdullah Hashash, 15, started confronting settlers and Israeli regime troops. They placed the homemade explosive object, according to a field investigation conducted by Defense for Children International Palestine. Mahdi approached the object when it fell out of place, and Israeli regime forces shot him in the leg 400 meters away. Even after Mahdi fell, Israeli regime troops continued to shoot at him and the explosive object, causing the bomb to go off and kill him. Residents of the area are regularly harassed and provoked by incursions into the site by Israeli settlers under heavy military guard. On November 5th, Israeli regime occupation forces killed a teen with 7 bullets at an intersection near the town of Senjil near Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Mus'ab Muhammad Mahmoud Zabin Nafal was 18. His body was handed over to Palestinian ambulance medics, according to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which conducts field investigations. During the same incident, Israeli regime forces also wounded his cousin, Nishan Dumar Zabin Nafal, 18. The Israeli regime army accused the teens of throwing stones and damaging vehicles. There were no Palestinian eyewitnesses to the incident, but PCHR concluded that the fact that Israeli regime occupation forces handed the corpse of the Palestinian teenager to ambulance attendants constitutes a new crime of extrajudicial execution and assassination. Israeli regime troops routinely use live fire against Palestinians they accuse of throwing stones or Molotov cocktails, even if there are no injuries to Israeli regime troops or settlers. It is legal under international humanitarian law for an occupied people to resist a military occupation. Meanwhile, on November 3rd, members of the Yamam unit of the Zionist regime's border police used a civilian minibus with a Palestinian license plate to sneak into Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. They barricaded a butchery where people were readying to celebrate the upcoming wedding of Farouk Jamil Hassan Salama, a commander of Islamic Jihad's military wing. Salama was fatally injured by gunshots to the chest, abdomen and head when a Yamam member opened fire on people inside the butchery. Others were wounded and five were arrested. The Zionist regime army later cordoned off Salama's house in the Jenin refugee camp while Palestinians threw stones at the invaders. The Zionist regime forces also shot and killed a 14-year-old boy near the entrance to the camp. Mohammad Samer Mohammad Khalouf had arrived at the entrance camp where others were confronting the Zionist regime army. He allegedly fired homemade gun at Israeli regime military vehicles, according to ZCPIP, which conducted a field investigation. Troops opened fire on Mohammad from 100 meters away, hitting him in the chest. On the same day, a man was killed by Israeli regime police after allegedly stabbing and moderately injuring an Israeli regime police officer in Al-Quds, Old City. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the man as Amer Hossam Badr, 20. Birzeit University, where Badr was a civil engineering student, mourned him with great pride. Two other Israeli regime policemen were wounded by their colleagues who were shooting at Badr. The day before, on November 2nd, a man accused of ramming a car into and attacking an Israeli regime troop with an axe was shot and killed by Israeli regime occupation forces. Footage reported to be of the incident shows a white minibus ramming into a person near a small structure and hitting a pole. Afterwards, the truck driver emerges from the vehicle and appears to attack the troop with an object. Apparently shot, the driver then falls to the ground. The troop was transferred to hospital with serious injuries, the army said. The Zionist regime military said it wished to avoid publication of documentation from the scene of the attack, which took place at checkpoint at entrance of Beir Or near Ramallah. But some media circulated footage purportedly showing the attack. The man accused of carrying out the operation was identified as Habas Abdul Hifa Yusuf Rayan, 54, by the Palestinian Health Ministry. He was from the village of Beit Duqu, northwest of Al-Quds. His son, Qosei Rayan, had been in Israeli regime prison when the incident took place. The Zionist regime detained him in September and he was released days after his father's killing. The day after killing Habas Rayan, the Israeli regime military raided his home and shot rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas canisters at protesters who had gathered nearby, PCHR reported. Palestinians threw stones in protest, and the Zionist regime military responded with live fire and more rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas, killing 42-year-old Dawood Mahmoud Khalil Rayan with a bullet to the chest. Mustafa Mirar, a resident living nearby, tried to help Dawood Rayan by pulling him into his yard and calling emergency services. Medical personnel arrived immediately, but the Zionist regime military denied them entry. PCHR said. Despite Rayan's critical condition, the Zionist regime army didn't allow medical crews to take him to hospital until half an hour later. Despite the Israeli regime's army's claims that Palestinians threw Molotov cocktails when Rayan was shot, Mirar and other eyewitnesses told PCHR's field workers that no Molotov cocktails were seen with protesters or Dawood Rayan, who did not pose any danger to Israeli regime troops that directly targeted him in his chest, PCHR said. Meanwhile, Palestine Chronicle reported, Israeli regime war minister Benny Gantz has approved a plan to build a 100-kilometer wall in the occupied West Bank, Israeli regime media has reported. Gantz made the announcement during a tour of the occupied territory recently. The new structure will be part of the West Bank apartheid wall, and according to Gantz, a 50-kilometer section of the wall will replace on the old fence. The other 50 kilometer was approved in April this year. Both sections will be equipped with surveillance cameras, sensors, and other technology, the Times of Israel cited the minister as saying. The Israeli regime apartheid wall is being built largely on occupied Palestinian land in the West Bank and East Al-Quds, they claimed.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. Why was Imam Khomeini sent into exile? Because a law was ratified by the direct order of the Shah, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, to the parliament of that day. Imam Khomeini did not tolerate this. He gave a long speech. Because of this speech, he was exiled for 13 years. This was an event that was almost directly related to the Americans. The second event was the killing of students. A number of children who were around your age were massacred in front of Tehran University. They were killed. We can't say the exact number because these sorts of statistics did not exist back then. But a number of them, even one is too many. A number of our dear children were martyred in front of Tehran University. This second event also took place on the 13th of Aban in 1978.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third event, which took place a year after that incident, after the victory of the revolution, was the students' attack on the American embassy. During that attack, many documents were found that revealed the United States' conspiracies against the Iranian nation. These documents have been published in 70, 80 volumes. You probably don't have the time to read these books, but there was a time when I told the Ministry of Education to include the schemes of these books in school textbooks. Unfortunately, they didn't do it. These documents show what the Americans were doing during the time they were in Iran. That is, from around the years 1949 or 1950, it shows their conspiracies and acts of treason. Well, there is a point to be considered here regarding the attack on the American embassy, which they actually called a spy den. And it really was. In their statements, advertisements, interviews, including the interview they conducted with me during my trip to New York when I was president, the Americans have introduced this event as the beginning of the dispute between the Iranian nation and the United States.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.